Thank you so much for being here. Really happy to see you all, and I'm really super delighted to be introducing this talk with Amy Tobin and Candice Hill Montgomery, who we're absolutely thrilled to have here for the first time in the UK since 1980s, I believe, 1981. My name's Lisa Panting, and I'm one of the founders of this gallery. And I'm just going to introduce Amy. So speaking with Candice today, we have Amy Tobin, who is Professor of Modern and Contemporary Art at the University of Cambridge and Curator, Contemporary Programmes, Kettle's Yard. She also co-edits the poetry in print, Distance No Object, with Luke Roberts. And we have this wonderful publication here called Must Sill, which is a poetry publication by Candice that we're also selling here at the gallery. And I highly recommend that you have a look and even buy a copy. So to Candice, we're sitting in A Bare Woman Mutters Nothing, which is your first solo exhibition in the UK. But you've been working for a long time, and I'll just start with from the 80s, perhaps. So in the 1980s, you exhibited at the Bronx Museum of the Arts and the New Museum in New York. And in 1980, your work was included in the infamous Times Square show, New York, organized by CoLab and Issue. Social strategies by women artists at, sorry, full stop. Then you were in Social Strategies by Women Artists at the Institute of Contemporary Arts London, curated by Lucy Lippard. And then in 1993, together with Lucy, you organized Working Artists, Working Women, Working Together at Gallery 1199, New York. And in 1985, you were awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship. So just fast forwarding a little bit to more recent exhibitions, you're currently included in Greater New York at MoMA PS1, and from the studio, 58 Years of Artists in Residence at Studio Museum in Harlem, New York. For Liberation and for Life, The Legacy of Black Dimensions in Art, the Albany Institute of History of Art, New York. And last year, Amy curated your work into Here is a Gale Warning, Crisis and Survival at Kettle's Yard, Cambridge. And at the same time, it was a previous summer, we hosted your work in Reluctant Gravities here at the gallery. I'd also just like to take this opportunity to share our deep debt to Amy Tobin for introducing your work to us. So we're really grateful for that introduction and for your stewardship of Candice's practice and for your wonderful writing on her work and for your really fantastic essay in Women Artists Together, Art in the Age of Women's Liberation. So the conversation will take place for about 30 minutes, and then we can take light questions. Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to be here in London with Candice. In some ways, like, I want to say at last, you know. We've known each other for about 10 years, haven't we? We've kind of been thinking and talking, and I've been diligently trying to write things. And it's been such a great pleasure to be introduced to, well, you know, I guess I began by being really interested in this work from the late 70s and early 80s, this incredibly prolific period, which Lisa kind of mentioned a few of the shows around. And then you suddenly find out that not only is that like a standout prolific period, it's like that the whole way through. You know, it's an incredible life and an incredible creative practice that extends across so many areas. And it's so special to be able to kind of talk with someone about what is an immense work. Yeah, appreciate you too very much. So yeah, we're going to talk today on the occasion of this wonderful exhibition, A Bare Woman Mutters Nothing. And I think what's really special about this is that it's a kind of survey, a mini survey of some of Candace's work. So you get a real flavor of the different directions that you've trod, but also the kind of inter-referential quality of your work. So things keep coming back and refined and transformed in new ways. And I think what's also important to say about your work, Candace, is that, you know, once you start kind of thinking with it, looking at it, living with it, more things come out of it all the time. And it's not just about you and your ideas, but it's about the world. It's about the people you've worked with, known, your family, your friends. And it's really generative as a kind of site for togetherness. You know, and Candace is restlessly attentive to the world in a way that I think is almost impossible to be. She manages to bring its chaos, its beauty, and its nonsense, you know, into these works, condensing complexity and never simplifying. She creates these kind of cryptic puzzles or enigmas that you see around you, which, you know, are not there to be always mysterious. They're there for us to process and to begin to make sense of or to begin to recognize things. And in that process of slow recognition, sometimes, you know, we can really make palpable what it is in the contemporary world, you know, and this is something that is always impossible to know when you're living it, but somehow it comes through you. In this incredible way, with also profound kind of beauty and vitality and energy. And in doing the work and in making this work, you also make a record or a log or a kind of epic poem that I think will serve to be a kind of, you know, a history of our times and of your times too. So we're going to unpack a few of the aspects of Candace's work in this conversation, some processes, approaches, part of her history. Thinking with the objects around us, hopefully, which extend, as I said, from the kind of late 1960s and early 1970s to the double exposure photographs and quilt, which were made in the 90s. And of course, the weaves, which she's been making on hand looms since around 2013. So in the spirit of this kind of mini survey, let's begin at the beginning. Could you share a little bit about how you got into art and how you became an artist?
Okay. Hello, everybody. It's a pleasure to see all of your faces and to be back in England, actually. I'm very happy here. Every time I come, I'm like, I should just be living here. It's such a pleasure to be here. The earliest memories, I guess, I have of my mom directing me to make art was about when I was about 11 or 12 years old. I went to art school, an art school that was started by a painter named Albert Pels, and he was a very well-known painter. I think in the 50s, who started an art school in Manhattan. And I was about 12 when I started there. And it was just adult, it was all men, I think, painting. So I was like a child, a black child in this environment with mostly Jewish men. And there were a lot of books around about different art styles, the Impressionists and Maurice Utrillo, and you know, in those days you learned how to make, well, I was already making art, that's why my mother knew that I should probably go to art school, because I had these paint boxes, oil paints, and we, you know, each child had their thing. My brother was a trumpet player, my sister played piano, you know, she saw our gifts, so I was just painting the landscape around me, and then when I went to the school, they really focused on traditional formalist ways of teaching art. I could say it's like, you know, the Michelangelo era or something, you know, you learn how to do drapery. And then there's this big canvas in the middle of the floor where these men who actually could paint the figure were doing abstraction. It's like they were working on one huge painting in the center of the floor. It was long, and you know, they invited me, oh, you can do something on here too. I was like, oh, wow, this is fun. So, you know, while you're learning how to do traditional painting, you're doing this abstraction in the middle of the floor. I think that's the reason today that I can combine abstract work and figurative work and not feel like there's a difference. I don't like say, oh, I'm gonna do an abstract painting today and a figurative work tomorrow. I just combine what I know and what I've seen done already and leave it at that.
Nice. Speaking of crossing boundaries, there's this description of you published in Interview magazine in 1984, where they say of you, Candace Hill Montgomery, a true artist of all media and a master of most. She's a poet, a painter, performer, musician, and photographer. And you've always kind of worked across, or at least from the kind of mid to late 1970s, worked across lots of different media. And your life itself has had lots of different creative outlets. You know, we're also sat underneath a photograph of you during your modeling career. Where does this kind of multidisciplinarity come from, and what does it mean to you?
Well, I got married when I was very young, mm-hmm. and I was on the beach in Long Island, and there was a woman who worked for a French designer, Jacques Tiffaut, and I'd never worked a day in my life. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was like, you know, when you get married young, you have children, you're kind of, back in those days, the middle class life kind of thought you were like gonna turn out to be nothing burger. You know, it's like, oh my God, here I am just looking at the water and trying to figure it out. And this woman who's renting a house mentioned this French designer that she worked for. And she said, oh, I think I should introduce you to him. And I said, oh, okay, you know. I think I was 18. And so I went into the city and met this man, and he hired me like the day I walked in there. And so that was in a building that had all the designers at the time. It was like, you know, like one building had Bill Blass designing, Tiffaut, Pauline Trigier, Anne Klein, you know, all of the designers were in this one building or the building next to it. So I started at Tiffaut, and really you never had to, I mean, it was perfect for me because I didn't know how to get up at a certain hour and go to work or anything. You could just walk in anytime you wanted to walk in. And he had a female partner. Her name was Beverly Bush. I'll never forget this woman. She was the money behind, you know, designers have money behind them. So they can do their thing while somebody else is paying the bills. And this woman, Beverly Bush, took three black girls. Think about this. It was a woman named Crystal Rampe, a woman I still see. She's a Shinnecock Indian, and I live in Southampton. I live in a township of Southampton. The Shinnecock Reservation is in Southampton. Although this girl didn't live in Southampton, she was a member of the Shinnecock tribe. And so he had hired three black girls to work. And that was the first time. It was like 1967, 68. We didn't even know nobody was hiring black girls. You know, it was, so we were all there, and she taught us business. This woman taught us the business of life and everything, how, you know, to save your money, everything. Because we didn't have mothers who actually knew this. They went to work, but they didn't know this larger area, this larger business that people were in. And I think if I didn't know that from young, I would have been really in trouble. Because I had a mother that kept saying, you can't do this forever. You have to get a real job. And this, she didn't realize this was a real job, you know. So this woman really taught us. She was like a mother to us. And Tifo died fairly young, but he gave all of us the opportunity to go freelance. And, you know, we didn't actually quit the job. It was, an everyday job. But mostly when people came in, you would put on the clothes and the runway was there, and that's how it was. And then there were agencies for runway, and then there were agencies for print. So I became a model that was known for runway and for print. And that's Bill Blass in the background. That's him standing in the doorway. And, it's like I was in the office all the time when, fabrics came in, and then he would say, what do you like? What do you want to wear? And then the other girl, we would have this whole argument about who wants to wear what. And, they would put me in the clothes that had, were kind of naked underneath. I had to really get over my fear of being nude without a body stocking or something, because I was a kid, It's like, you're not used to strangers seeing you, your whole body. And that really paid for my college education and everything else.
Yeah. And we've talked before about how, I guess one can sort of read a kind of fashion model experience as being somewhat kind of objectified, or the agency is kind of lost in some way, but in fact you found it actually quite empowering, right?
Yeah, I that was probably before the era of the supermodel. We did make that same big money, but it all went into houses and cars and private schools for the children, and it wasn't quite. Then the second wave became, with Pat Cleveland and Iman, and they came after the first wave of the black model, I'd say.
And so, you've incorporated one of these images of you into this work, and, in some senses, we see this, amazing feather dress that you're wearing in this image, kind of echoing and ricocheting with the kind of textile work, the weave. And I just wondered if you could say a bit about, how you kind of began to expand from kind of painting and drawing, leaving aside also the enormous body of work in installation, but to kind of think more about, the quilt form, and the weave. So thinking about your grandmothers,
Well, my grandmothers. My father is from Alabama. The South, Southern, that's where all the horrible stuff still is, mostly. That's where my father's father's from, and my family spent summers there until Emmett Till was murdered in 1955. So my father's mother was the quilt maker, and even though she didn't really teach us how to quilt, quilts were there on the beds, and the quilting is not hard to do. It's just a couple of layers of things that you're sewing together. They're not, and my northern grandmother is from Jamaica, West Indies, and she taught me how to knit and crochet, and she did rugs and all of those things. Without patterns, she could do anything. Her mother owned a store also. She was a dressmaker. And I used to ask her to make me all my things. I'd say, I want a red Angora sweater with pearl buttons coming down, short sleeves, crop top, blah, blah, blah. And finally she said, you have to learn how to make these things yourself. You know, I was always afraid that I couldn't do it as well as she could do it. That's why I didn't want to do, you know. It's like when you see professional people doing a professional job, you never think you can do anything as well. And really, it's like, you know, putting each part of the garment together and then sewing it together afterwards. Well, she taught me how to do that part once she knew that I really wanted to do that. The hardest part of that is like cable knitting and, you know, those intricate intricate steps. I kept a lot of our sweat because I made my children's sweaters for years that were amazing, like the stripes in a painting, you know. You can do, once you know how to do the basics, you can do anything you want because it's not difficult. I always tell people that if you have the desire to do, you know, stitch work, handwork, is not that difficult. And sometimes I still do knitting, like the Tom Petty piece that just went, that has a knitted part. Sometimes I do weaves and then there's a knitted part just to remind myself.
To keep it fresh.
Keep it fresh.
Yeah. Maybe could you tell us a bit about how you go about making these weaves?
What do you mean how?
Well, use a hand loom.
Yes.
Walk us through, like, do you draw it out beforehand and then follow a plan?
I don't do any thinking about it before I start something. I decided to design a loom that was a square, no matter whether except for that piece and of course that one and, you know. But most of them are like squares. 12 by 12 or 15 by 15 or something. 25 by 25 is the largest I really do, and then I'll put them together to make a larger weave. Because really, the thing about weaving is they're tiring after a point. You get to a point where you're like, please be over soon. Please don't leave me in this another month, you know? And so if you start small, then you don't ever have to, because they go fast, you know? It's like maybe a month and a half, let's say. I just generally start with the bottom color and start working upward. And then something else comes to mind. And then I add little by little, and then it becomes slightly clearer. But I don't draw anything out because once I do drawings, and they're not like the weaves. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That the drawing part is a whole different mindset. The weaves are unto themselves. They're not like the paintings. They're not like. I mean, they kind of look like paintings, but they're really, I don't have that same mindset with any different medium. I do use different mediums just because one isn't enough to say everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But they are kind of pictorial, or like they have often sort of images within them and patterns within them. And sometimes there's like symbols that kind of hop across different works as well. And I guess when you're looking at them, it's like one adjusts your eyes, don't you? You kind of focus in and out and different things emerge as you look and see. But is there a point where you know what the weave is going to be when you're doing it, or?
That's a good question. I don't know. Because I'm surprised sometimes with what they turn out to be. Yeah, there's enough abstraction there that they could be one thing or another.
And sometimes it's almost like a premonition, isn't it? Like, you know, you've made a weave, and then I remember one of the ones we had at Kettle's Yard later, you gave it a title because it sort of fitted historic events, right. And it's like, yeah.
Sometimes the titles come later, sometimes the titles come first, but usually later.
Do you want to talk about titles? Because that's one of the truly extraordinary things about your work are the titles?
Well, when I first started, they were more Shakespearean. You know, they were these long titles that a little were like, oh my God, could I shut up? You know, because it's like I was trying to match William. yeah. They're a little shorter now, and they're generally poetic asides. Let's put it like that. They're asides, and you can see with the quilt, they're proverbs. You know, they're like titles in a way. They're saying something that we as humans should live by, but it can be placed anywhere, you know, onto anything. And these just happen to be, you know, like squashed into one quilt. But titles are fun to me because they're almost like another person, if they're a poet, can then take that title and do something else with it. I'm a big one for, I like other people to see something in my work and then use it to either write or, you know, there's enough like, of a non-entity. What's going on here between these things? Mm-hmm. And then if you see something like a pathway into your own thought processes, then really that's what I'm happy about, you know?
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of also the ethics of your work as well, because so many of the weaves in particular incorporate kind of what I guess in art history we would call like found objects, but in your case these objects of all different kinds of provenance. So they are like sometimes things that were your father's or grandparents, or things that you found kind of washed up, or things that you've sought out and collected. Like, can you tell us a bit about why these fragments and
well, my father's a real collector. And he, you know, my mother's always, don't bring another thing in this house type thing. He'd go south to visit his mother and he'd come back with a trunk full of something or other. That's the stuff that's at PS1, a lot of it, you know. Been in the house for 60 years or something. And I was the child that picked up on, there are things out there that can be used in other ways, you know, because he'd put them up over the fireplace or something, or he was a real artist and who didn't get a chance to do art, you know? And although he raised artists, what can I say? Yes, I do find things. I find a lot of things. The great, I don't know how I can still lift these heavy things. I tell you, I brought something home last week. The thing was so heavy, I could barely put it in the trunk. You know, I find, because living in Long Island, people, you know, there are a lot of house building. There's a lot of, you know, iron around. A lot of things that are just. You know, bent, and they look great. I mean, things that are bent look great. Do we have any of those? No, I don't think in this show there's a lot of African stuff in this. But yes, this one. Oh, yeah. A street find.
Yeah.
I didn't make that.
But it's also, it's also like a kind of drawn line, and like the line is really key as well in your work and in the way the kind of woven line and the drawn line kind of intersect and, sure. You know. It's big thing. Can we talk about the cash sacks in some of these works? So quite a few of the weaves have these cash sacks kind of elements. And they're doing all kinds of different work. Do you want to say a bit about where they're from and why they're here?
Let's see how to put this nicely.
Sorry, I left that to you.
They hide the pubic area of African girls from about age 12. So maybe I glommed onto this because, you know, it's like the whole nudity thing with me and modeling, I had to get used to it. And when I found out about the cash sexes, I was like, whoa, this is how, nude on top, and then just covering the pubic area, pubis. And then some of them, you know, when you find something that's 19th century or very old, sometimes you don't find the entire object. You know, it's like at first I only got the ones that were the triangular part. And then the bit that went around the girl's waist to hold it up, mm-hmm. that is that part, on, you know, oh, there. Yeah. And then, you know, I was even more fascinated because they're welded and then they're actually sewn at the top. So when I add them, I'm trying not to disturb the actual maker's mark, let's say, you know, and that's not so easy to do because you got to put the needle in between these parts that are open, mm-hmm. and then hopefully it stays on the weave mm-hmm. enough. And then, you know, the other part is a little easier to do. And then they have a wire sometimes, and then some beads on there. So I'm getting the good ones now. They have, you know.
Elaborate.
And these women walk around. And I have two that I haven't used that are so heavy. How these girls walk around with this stuff on, because it's heavy just to hold them with two hands. And they've got them around their waist, and they're from mostly from the Kuba tribe and from the Cameroon. And I've got people on the lookout, so don't try going to get these.
Yeah, unless you're going to send them to Candace, stay away. And you know the. I mean, with many of the materials, but particularly, you know, with these, there's also a kind of metaphoricity to using them. So,
well, I was using them. I started using them at the same time with the Jeffrey Epstein file thing. I thought that was the perfect time to bring them. That's what started me on using them in the weaves. The story of those girls and the, you know. Yeah, sometimes you wait to use things until it's the proper moment in history to bring out, okay, here's the African woman that you're taking away kind of all of the money for injections and, you know, the measles and everything. And they're already practically bare. And then this is what you did over here. So it clicks in a way. You know, your mind has to do something to want to make something about that. I've had them, but I didn't know where they fit. And that's the thing about, you know, all of these things, this American side of tragedy. Mm-hmm. And also, we can't get away from how other people have let their people, languish, as we could say. Or maybe they don't think that it's a hot country, you know. Maybe they like wearing those. Who knows?
And one of the things, you know, we were talking about the other day when we were looking at the show all together was, this sense of, I think Luis, in fact, said protection was something he kept thinking about because of this very early painting that's around the corner from us, having this sort of protective older figure or taller figure sort of creating a sort of barrier for this younger figure who's sort of crouching beneath them. And they have this amazing yellow coat which billows out behind them. And then we have the cash sex, which are both like something that's, I guess, about like covering up or, you know, a cover up like the Epstein case and also is protective in some way or another. And then, you know, you were also talking about the title of the exhibition in that respect too, this idea of the bear. Do you want to say anything about the protective, the...
Well, read the title out again. I'd have to be... It's like the a bear woman mutters nothing.
This is the problem, Candace, with these titles that, like, are just, like, too intense. A bear woman mutters nothing. Should we see if our adoring crowds have any questions for you? Yeah. Does anyone have any questions or thoughts or comments or anything they'd like to share? Are you sure now? Oh, yes, you are. You have one.
Heard stories about it. It's just in my mind, you know, I taught for 35 years. I taught art for 35 years. So you're giving out all you know about what you want your students to learn, and, you know, how to do abstraction, and how it's not exactly your work. It's basic art training, and you hope that people are able to take basic art training, whether it's color field. You know, I went to college later under the color field artists, you know, the color field and the conceptualists, Robert Morris, and, you know, so one branch wanted color, because people back in the days when, you know, you went to art colleges, wanted you to follow in footsteps of some school. Yeah. And so there were two schools battling each other at that moment. Doug Olson and Robert Swain and all the color field people. And then Robert Morris and, you know, Michelle Stewart, who does land art, she was probably the teacher who I had in graduate school who really showed me the path to environmental art the most. So it isn't a direct, you know what I mean? It's just a complete learning that I feel like I give people enough of an opening that they can either do language, more of language. We haven't talked really about that, about the book, you know. But, you know, I like language in visual art, but I don't overdo it. The title generally says enough if it's like, but then there are people who love to just use language with a little sprinkling of color around, you know? So whichever way you want to do those things, you know, I'm always drawn to, let me write something here and let it go with that. And, you know, just, but I can't do it. I do one thing. Mm-hmm. I always say one thing, you know, the drawing or the writing or the painting, it's one thing. So therefore it looks like I do a lot of things, but I don't, I just compartmentalize. The things that I do.
But also, I think a lot of your works are sort of gathering things and holding them together. And obviously, that's not as like, or maybe one could think it's like a sort of incidental thing of like, oh, this is good or this is good. But it's very careful, and you know, you're always calibrating it and, you know, figuring out how things should go together or not. But that's also. Yeah, it's like collage, isn't it? But it's like a kind of megalomania collage that's in the best possible way. But, you know, you also said, I love this quote, because when you talked about teaching high school once, and you were sort of talking about the work that you were making around that time, sort of using, you know, references to the Black Panther Party or to kind of particular activists. And this, I guess, was sort of not very long after the kind of heyday of those revolutionary struggles. And you said, like, you wanted to use your art and use your teaching to keep old truths in the Black struggle against imperialism circulating. And I love that idea that the work can kind of hold and sustain these histories, lots of ethics, lots of politics, but also it does it in this way that's also really about material and color, feeling and life.
Well,
and
right after I painted the Sag Harbor, the two girls, the 1971 piece, that piece has only been shown in one show all these years. It was shown when Angela Davis was put in prison. And we were working on a defense fund for her. And so artists got together and you know, chose what art they were gonna sell to raise money for that. And the funny thing about that piece, I chose that piece because it was so different than some woman who's going to be in jail or is in jail. It's so idyllic. And the way you want your girls to live without hassle or reproach or, you know, they're thinking their own thoughts and what are those thoughts and what beach are they on and, you know, can you still get that color? Because it's very Kodachrome color, which I wasn't even thinking about, but it's not a very vibrant, except for the yellows. And I chose it because I thought there's going to be all kind of revolutionary pictures in this, you know, the Statue of Liberty with the hand up and she's black or whatever. I'm going to put that so we remember the kind of life we want to be living, a peaceful life, and whatever is, however you do that, it's okay. And a lot of people want you to, you know, if you have thoughts about how things can change, they want you to make art that looks like that all the time. And once you do, then they don't want to show you again because it scares them to death. And you're canceled, you know. That's what happened with Historic Extinction series. You know, I used all those photographs of all the police rounding up people and, you know, it was all black and white, it was huge. It went into the Bronx Criminal Courthouse and, you know, did I ever get asked to do another show like that? No. Because people say they want you to do that, but then once they see it and see the reality of what is happening, it's like that's not, you know, yeah. So I began to think about how to do it better, how to make the case for the peaceful reality and showing what's also going on in a different way. That got to the weaves.
Wow, thank you. I think that is a really good place to stop. Yeah. And if anyone does have any questions, I'm sure we can handle one or two on a more intimate basis. So feel free to come over. But please, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you, Candace.